Alrighty, guys. Welcome to this episode of Pete's Two Cents. This is where I answer your questions. So, I am currently opening up Instagram and I'm going to try to get to the questions that you guys all asked me earlier this week on Monday. So, I'm going to have to scroll down, scroll down, scroll down. Go quite a way. Oh, man. Maybe it's not even going to have... No, I can't even go further. All right. I think the good thing is I screenshot all of these questions and put them onto my phone. So, that would have been an easier way of doing it. But, yeah, okay. So, here we are. But before we get started, guys, don't forget that there are no transcripts for these episodes because I do them very quickly and upload them to my team and they upload them almost the same night or the same, usually within a few days. So, yeah, the whole point of these are for you to obviously work on your listening comprehension and for me to be able to answer these questions you have and get them published really quickly. Okay, so, all right, what do we got here? Do you say apartment or flat in Australia? This comes from Whisper of Ocean. Do you say apartment or flat? I would probably say both, to be honest. You know, it would depend, but you hear so frequently the two used that it's just kind of become normal. So, I think what the person's getting at is that flat is usually seen as American English and apartment is British English. I think that's the right way around. And so, effectively, it is where you live in a house that is on land that is shared with other people who live in different houses that are other flats or apartments, right? Or if you live in a high-rise building, you have a flat or an apartment because it's not a standalone house, right? It's not a, standalone house. So, we would use apartment and flat in Australia. I think I would probably lean towards an apartment. I would say that, you know, like when I was going to university, I used to live in South Bank in Melbourne and we had a share house, right? A share house. I guess it would be not a share house because it wasn't a house, it was an apartment. It'd be a share apartment. Share house is what we can use though to talk about a place that you live where you share it with other people. So, usually other students, you live in different rooms. It's a share house, even if it's in an apartment or a flat and not an actual standalone house by itself. It's a share house because you're sharing the place with someone else or multiple other people. So, yeah, I had a share house that was an apartment in South Bank. And then later in life, ended up moving into, I think it would have been a townhouse that we were sharing. So, I had other students and other people in there renting with me. And then eventually got my own place with a friend. And so, we had a literal share house, if that makes sense. It was an actual house and it was a share house. So, yeah, hopefully that answers your question. You can use both. People will know exactly what you mean. This one comes from Michael. He said, Australia got into the FIFA World Cup. How epic is that? Yeah, that was great. I was really pumped to see Australia doing well. I think we scored a penalty, right? It went to penalty shootout and we ended up getting through. So, that was phenomenal to hear that, yeah, we made it in. Usually, we don't do too well from memory. The men's team, at least. I think the Matildas, the female team, does really well. But the men's team, we just can't do that well against places like Brazil or, you know, Spain or the teams from England and everything like that. You know, we just don't have the same kind of... What would you say? That... Ironically, in Australia, soccer is the sport that has the highest number of clubs and I think attendees. So, even though we have sports like AFL and cricket and rugby and tennis, all those sorts of things, soccer or football, if you want to use the British term for it, or, well, I guess you Europeans and people from other places will call it that as well. Brazilians will call it football. What was I saying? Yeah, there's more clubs and more people who play that sport than any other sport in Australia. So, you think we'd do good? Well, you think we would do well, but because I guess we only have a country of 25 million people and, some other countries like Brazil, Brazil's got like, what, 300 million people? 260 million people? Something crazy. They have a lot more talent to pull from putting together teams to play soccer and then taking them to the World Cup. So, that's why they dominate so well. All right, this one comes from Non-Toxic. What are the most important things to take on a trip to Australia besides your passport and stuff? Well, I guess it depends on what kind of trip you're taking, right? Are you coming to Australia, but you're going to spend most of your time in suburbia or in cities, right? Like, are you coming and traveling around the big cities, or are you going to go into the bush, right? Are you going to go into the outback and be off the grid, right? Without reception, without electricity, without running water, that sort of stuff. Because obviously, those are two very different situations where you're going to need very different gear, if you know what I mean. So, if you go out into the sticks, right, out into the bush, you're going to need all sorts of survival equipment, food and water, a tent, somewhere to sleep, obviously, you know, shelter, food and water, they're the main things you need. Clothing too, probably. I guess that sort of falls under the realm of shelter. You're sheltering your body from the outside world. But yeah, if you're going into the bush, I think it's that kind of thing of make sure you have enough water, make sure you have something to eat, make sure that you have a first aid kit. If you're going to be four-wheel driving or taking a dirt bike or something off-road, know what to do if you get stuck. Don't just come to Australia and buy a four-wheel drive and then just chuck it in and go out into the sticks and think you'll be sweet. That's how people get in trouble, get lost, and can potentially die. If you mean, though, just in general, coming to Australia, oh, man, what can you bring? What's the most important? What are the most important things? An open mind and a good work ethic, if you want to get a little more existential. I think don't overthink it. Bring what you think you'll need. You know, obviously, have enough money in the bank. Have your clothes sorted out. Have something to do on the plane. And then when you get here, you'll work it out. At least, that's how I work. I kind of ride by the seat of my pants, right? That's a good expression for you guys, to ride by the seat of your pants. It's kind of like just to wing it and to just take it as it comes. You know, to just take on reality. What I want is destiny. That's what I want to say. Destiny. Take that on. Just see what happens as it comes. So, yeah, I would say that probably. I think one thing to be aware of is where you're going to be landing in Australia and which season it's going to be. Because if you're, say, coming from, I don't know, Rio in Brazil, and you come to Hobart in Tasmania, and it's winter, it's the middle of winter, like at the moment, you're probably going to get off the plane and it might be 5 degrees Celsius. It might be colder. It could be 0 degrees. It could be below zero. So, you would obviously want to pack a lot of warm clothing. And if you're someone who lives in somewhere like Rio or, say, you know, the tropics right on the equator, you probably don't have a lot of gear to deal with temperatures that are below, I don't know, what, 20 degrees? I think my wife came to Australia and she was like, I can't believe it gets down to 20 degrees here. This is crazy. And she was living in Queensland at the time. And I was like, just you wait. Just you wait until you come to Melbourne. So, yeah, I think having the right clothing and sunscreen, bug repellent, you know, fly spray, that sort of stuff. Fly spray. Probably not fly spray. That's to kill flies. Bug repellent, the stuff to put on your body to keep insects, mozzies, other bugs away, especially if you're going into places like Queensland during summer and stuff. So, yeah, just being aware of those sorts of things and making sure when you get here that you look around and learn about what's important to know, right? So, like, if you end up somewhere like Far North Queensland or in Darwin, somewhere more remote, it's very important that you obviously work on your survival skills and get a bit of an understanding of the cultural expectations around the place, right? Like, so, if I went to Darwin tomorrow, and we went to a beach, I got off the bus and we were at a beach, I would be staying the hell away from the water, right? There's crocodiles, bull sharks, stinging jellyfish, all sorts of shit that will kill you in the water there. Even though it looks inviting, it looks beautiful, looks amazing, stay the hell away from the water. But a lot of people don't know that, right? If you just pick Darwin out of a hat and decided you're going to go there, it looks beautiful, and you didn't do your research, do your due diligence. That's a tongue twister. Due diligence. Do your due diligence. Do your due diligence. Jesus. Yeah, if you didn't do your research beforehand, you could get yourself into a bit of trouble. So, yeah, rabbit it on a bit there, but hopefully that answers your question. All right, let's see if we can find some more interesting questions. This one comes from Josie Mayer. Is it true that the water at the beach is extremely cold? That's going to depend where you live. Again, so if you are probably, and it probably depends on where you come from, right? If you've got someone coming from Iceland to Australia, they're probably going to get in the water anywhere here and be like, this is like a sauna. Whether it's Queensland or Tasmania, they're going to be like, this is really warm. But if you're coming from somewhere like the tropics, right? If you come from Indonesia or from Ecuador or, you know, wherever along the tropics, you're going to be, in most places in Australia, probably thinking the water's a bit colder than what you're used to if you live near the coast and you go to, you know, the beach quite frequently. So, yeah. Around here in Melbourne, it's not too bad during the summer, especially at the end of summer because it's had all summer to heat up. So, the water temperature usually around the south here of Australia will get up to about 18 degrees Celsius, I think, in summer, at the end of summer, which is kind of refreshing if the temperature is 30 degrees or over. If it's a bit colder than that, maybe high 20s is okay too, but if it gets to like 20 degrees and you get in the water and the water's 18 degrees, you get cold pretty quick. I think, at least from memory, that's what it used to be like for me. However, if you go further north, I think once you get past somewhere like Sydney, the water is just lovely, right? I think it's, you know, 20 degrees, 22 degrees. I remember being in, I think we would have been in Cairns. And then I was doing some turtle tagging, some research with scientists on Rain Island, the place was called. I think I've talked about this on the podcast before, but we went to Rain Island, which is even further north than Cairns. I think it was like 2 days by boat to get there. And I remember just getting off the boat and putting my feet in the water and just being like, good God, this is like I'm sitting in a spa. So, the Great Barrier Reef, anyone who's gone to the Great Barrier Reef, especially the northern parts, you'll know the water's just incredibly warm all year round. And I remember for me, at least, that was a very foreign thing. So for someone who grew up in Melbourne, Geelong, you know, down here in the southeast of Australia, where the water's pretty cold, you know, in winter it gets to 11 degrees and your hands can freeze up and the blood stops running to your fingers. It's that cold. When I was in Queensland, it sort of blew my mind that you could sit in the water and it was really warm, like it had been heated up for you, right? Someone had set the bath up for you and you got to sort of sit in it. The annoying thing was, during summer, when it was really humid and hot, you would think, oh, man, I'm going to jump in the water and cool off. And you wouldn't get that same kind of refreshing cold, well, I don't know, like a bath kind of experience, right? You would jump in the water and you'd be like, well, it's just as bloody warm as it is out of the water. So, this is sort of unpleasant. So, I remember that kind of being annoying. I remember being, this would have been at Bundaberg, Monrepeau. I was doing turtle research there. This is when I spent a lot of time in Queensland. If you ever go to Bundaberg, go to Monrepeau. It's French for my, I think, rest. Repos, like repose yourself, right? To rest. And go and check out the turtles there. You can do tours at night where they'll show you turtles laying eggs. If you go, I think, from November till about December, January. And if you go after that, January, February, and even March, you'll probably get to see maybe some turtles laying eggs. It'll be the end of the season. But what you will get to see is potentially the nests hatching, and that's where you have hundreds sometimes, maybe even thousands, depending on the beach, of little hatchling turtles running down the beach at night and getting into the water all at once. So, yeah, it's crazy up there. But anyway, I remember being at Bundaberg and, yeah, it was hot, jumping in the water and being like, this is not what I'm after. This is not hitting the spot. And it was the same thing. I went to Rain Island. Yeah, I did that. I went to Heron Island. That was another place we did. And I bring up Heron Island because I remember there was a story I wanted to tell you about the turtles coming out of a nest. So, effectively, what happens is the female turtle will come up early in the season, right? Usually, November, December, January. And she comes up once every 2 weeks and lays a batch of eggs. And depending on the species, it's about, I don't know, anywhere from 50 to 130 eggs. Usually, around 100, right? And the eggs will sit there for a certain period of time. And the temperature of the beach, based on the sand color, quite often, that determines the gender, the sex of the turtles in the nest. So, I think there's a threshold when the temperature gets past 32 degrees, I think they all become male. And if it's below 30 degrees, they're all female. So, if it's between 30 and 32, you end up with a sort of mixed ratio of both males and females. It's kind of cool. It's like crocodiles where I think crocodiles are the same thing, where the temperature determines the sex of the individual in the nest. So, anyway, the nests are there and they're all over the beach. You just would have to dig down a foot, maybe 2 feet, to be able to find them, you know, if you knew where to look. And so, I remember I was doing counting on Heron Island, and it's this tiny island, but it gets loads of these green sea turtles coming up at night. You know, normally around sunset, they start coming up. And then the last ones will leave during sunrise. You know, they prefer to be up there at night. When it's dark, they'll dig the nest and they will lay a bunch of eggs. But we were there, I think, probably in January, February, doing our work. And so, we had turtles coming up. It wasn't a great deal, like a lot of them. But the interesting thing was that the turtle nests would quite often explode during the night. You would just see the look like the ground was moving and the turtles, hundreds of them, were running into the water. So, one night we finished and I remember you would sometimes find these sort of dugout pits in the sand where the turtle had come up and they move all the sand around to fill the hole in, but it leaves kind of like a pit afterwards that you can sit in. And it was like 5 a.m. and I just decided, you know, I'm wrecked. I'd been walking around since midnight doing all the turtle stuff, taking all the data, counting the turtles that came up, how many eggs they laid, all that stuff. And then I went to sleep and I remember waking up with all this movement around my bum, right? Around my bum that was in the middle of this pit. And I kind of shat myself. I was like, what the hell is happening? Because, you know, you half wake up and your mind is sort of trying to work out where you are, what you're doing. And I was on the beach in this pit in the sand, right? Like sort of above the high tide mark. And all of a sudden, all these little creatures came out around my bum and just started making all of this sort of shh noise as they were moving the sand around. And it was hundreds of little sea turtles. And I think I'd obviously disturbed them in the late morning there and they had all erupted out of their nest. And so, right up and under me, all these little baby turtles hatched out of their eggs. Oh, actually, they hatch out the night before and then they wait there near the surface all together for the temperature of the sand to cool down so they know it's nighttime. So, I guess that's what happened, right? The temperature would have dropped, would have been morning. They didn't realize that it was still morning or it had just become morning and so they erupted through because I disrupted them. Anyway, that was a really cool sight. And I remember sitting there in this pit and just watching dozens of these little turtles running down the sand, getting to the water as quickly as they could. And then, you know, it turned into many dozens. And then I could, you know, count 100 or so were just all running down together. And they got into the water. And once they got to the water, because it was daytime, a lot of sharks and seagulls and other predators were just tearing into them. So, the unfortunate thing is for those turtles, when you see those turtle hatchlings, is that I think it's about a 1 in 1,000 chance that any given hatchling will return to lay eggs. So, will survive to adulthood, right? So, I think it's about 1 in 1,000 that survive. So, I guess it'd be 1 in 500 that would return, right? Because only the females come back to lay eggs. The males, once they are into the water, once they've run down as hatchlings, that is the last time that they are on the land. After that, they never come ashore. It's only the females who come ashore to lay the eggs. Anyway, there you go. A bit of biology for you guys. All right. What is the best economic Aussie way for making a house warm enough in winter? Good question. This comes from Ali. I think I know Ali. I think I used to give Ali lessons when I first started. So, thank you for the question, Ali. He lives in Melbourne, if I have the right person. And so, like me, he experiences the cold during winter. I think the most economic way of doing so would be living in a newer house because they tend to have more regulations around new buildings and the energy efficiency of the house nowadays. So, if you get a newer house, usually they have all these standards like the windows have to be double glazed, which means, you know, they retain heat or keep the heat out, depending on the season. They'll also have a lot of insulation in the walls and in the roof and everything like that to maintain the temperature of the house, keep it cold in summer, cool in summer, and warmer in winter. And then the heating systems are probably going to be up to date as well, and you're going to have, you know, at least in our house, I think we have central heating. So, it's you just turn it on and we pretty much just leave it on at a certain the thermostat level, I think it's usually like 18 degrees and it'll just maintain that temperature throughout the house. And so, yeah, I mean, so to save money, we kind of don't go crazy with the heating. You know, we're not going to pump it up to 22, 23 and just be walking around the house in a bikini and, you know, a singlet and thongs, even in winter. I say that because we had a guy come over recently who had to get into the roof and replace part of the heating unit. And I remember saying to him, I was just, you know, shooting the breeze, so just making small talk and being like, do you ever go to people's houses to replace these things and just come across really weird shit? Like, I love asking tradies who come past, like plumbers and electricians and this guy who was doing the gas or whatever in the heating unit, those sorts of questions, because you always get really interesting answers when they, like, you ever come into someone's house and just see something really weird or that they've been doing something strange? And he said he went to someone's house, and I think he said they were from India or Sri Lanka or something, and that they had the thermostat set to 27 degrees in winter, and that it was just like a sauna when he went into the house. And this isn't to make fun of Sri Lankans or Indians, but to give you the background to show you that they're obviously used to a certain temperature, right? If you come from a country like Sri Lanka or India or even Brazil, you would just have usually a tolerance for a certain heat. Whereas for me, anytime the temperature gets above like 19, 20 degrees and I'm taking a jumper off, I'm just like, it's too hot. I feel weird walking around the house in a t-shirt. I always have pants on unless it's hot outside, and so it's warm inside and I'll put shorts on. So anyway, that's, I guess, a long way of saying that be sensible with your heating. Obviously, in winter months, if you're not using certain parts of the house and you can avoid heating those, you know, like say an extra bedroom or an office or something, then lock those away and don't have them open and requiring heating, which is why I think I'm looking up and... Yeah, we've got little vents in this room as well. I think there must be in every room of the house except probably the dunny, the toilet, might even be there. But what was the point I was trying to make? Yeah, so just being careful, I guess, being conscious. What's the temperature you can handle? Don't pump it up to something ridiculous where you're walking around in a singlet and thongs. Buy clothes that are warm and wear them inside. Get slippers, wear socks. You know, if you've got like a fireplace, you can use it. You can use it all the time if you really want, but I think if you're buying a lot of wood, it's a very expensive way of heating the house. It's kind of romantic. It's kind of nice. It's kind of, I don't know, there is a certain romance to it, right? Having a fire going, hearing the crackling, feeling the heat close up, seeing the flames move and the lights kind of coming out of the thing horizontally as opposed to having that light from the top. I love fires, but that would be a way of burning through a lot of money, because I remember buying wood for the wood heater that we had back at the house that we had in Ocean Grove. It was like $30 for, I don't know, 20 kilos of wood or whatever it was. And you'd go through half of that in a night if you tried to heat the house. So, that's like, what, 15 bucks or something, you know? So, it can get pretty expensive pretty quickly if you're using a wood heater in your house. So, yeah. Hopefully, that's made sense. All right, let's keep going. This is a good one. So, this one comes from FGK. FGK, which one is correct? I'd better go or I better go? Thanks. That is a really good question. I think you could use these interchangeably. So, I'd better go is the contracted, quickly spoken form of I had better go. And if you had better go, it is, I guess if you say you better do something, it's like you should do that thing, you must do that thing, like, oh, I'd better go. It's like, I should go, I need to go, I'm required to leave because of something else. But I wonder if it's because we contract it to I'd better go, and it sounds like I better go, that we just use I better go when it should be I had better go, contracted to I'd better go, or if both are for whatever reason, right? Because I think, yeah, if you were to say, look, it's getting late, I'd better go, I had better go, that's fine. I would understand exactly what you mean. You need to go home. It's getting late. You want to go to sleep, or you want to go do something else, or you've got some other sort of engagement. Whereas if you said, it's getting late, I better go, it means exactly the same thing, right? I need to go. I should leave. So, I think you can use both. I honestly think you could use both, and yeah, no one would bat an eyelid. No one would blink. No one would be surprised. All right. Let's go. What are we looking at here? Okay. What's the meaning of struth? Also, you're awesome. Keep up the good work. Thank you. Thank you so much. This comes from Ave. Okay. Ave says, what's the meaning of struth? So Struth, and you've spelled it kind of like S-T-R-U-T-H. I think I would spell it S-T-R-E-W-T-H, Struth. And this is something that people like, usually males say. It's kind of one of those kind of slangy terms to show shock and surprise and that you're impressed by something. So, you know, if someone shows up in a new car and you're really impressed, you might be like, whoa, Struth, what a nice car. But it's a very kind of ocker thing to say. You know, you have to kind of have that full accent going where your full Aussie accent's at. Oh, Struth, mate. Yeah, Struth. Oh, Struth. Struth. So, it tends to be a kind of Aussie male thing. Though, that's not to say girls listening don't learn this word, don't say this word, because I think, ironically, you can get away with using it because it's so endearing. We love hearing foreigners learning Australian English and using these slang terms, even if it is kind of slightly out of character. Like, you guys can get away with saying a lot of things that I can't because it would seem weird and native speakers would have a certain event. They'd have a certain expectation of other native speakers that when it's a non-native speaker, you don't have the same expectation, right? This happens to me in Portuguese all the time. When I'm speaking with my wife, I can say certain things that I think if another Brazilian said them, she'd be like, that's weird, right? So, I can't think of anything off the top of my head. But yeah, that's... I know that that's happened a few times where I would say certain things. Okay, a good example would be... I always say this, and Brazilians are going to laugh. Eu vou fazer xixi, right? So, that is effectively, I'm going to do a wee. I'm going to go to the toilet, I'm going to do a wee. So, I'll say that, you know, or I'll say to my son, você vai fazer xixi? You need to do a wee. You're going to do a wee? But I think that it's a very feminine way of saying you're going to do a wee. And so, when I say that, my wife knows what I mean and she doesn't blink, but other Brazilians would look at you and be like, why are you saying it that way? You're a guy. So, you know, you should say something like, eu vou mijar. I think that's it. That might be a little ruder, I'm not sure. But mijar is like the male version of like, I'm going to take a piss. And I think in English, in Australian English, if you said, I'm going to do a wee as an adult, wee means to, you know, do a number one, do a pee, urinate, piss. But it's the way that you would talk about it with children. So, oh, you're going to do a wee? Do you need to do a wee? You know, that's how I would speak to my son. I wouldn't say to him, do you need to take a piss? Because it's just kind of too informal, slightly rude, and not very kind of endearing language you would use with your child. But if my wife said it, I'd probably just laugh. Like, do you need a piss, Noah? So, anyway, yeah. Struth. If you're a woman and you want to say struth, don't be afraid of doing it. People will probably love it. But yeah, it's used for shock, surprise, to show that you're impressed by something. Steve Irwin used to always say this. Oh, struth. So, you'll hear this sometimes, occasionally, usually from pretty ocker guys in Australia. They'll just be sort of using this kind of language to really show off their blokiness, their Aussiness, and saying these kinds of phrases. Yeah, struth. Oh, struth. So, yeah, whip that out. Next time you're around Australians and something happens that shocks or surprises or impresses you, just whip out a nice little struth. You know, sort of really trail it out there, like get it going longer, struth, and see how they react. I think they're gonna smile. All right, so that's been about half an hour, guys. I have just gotten a text from my wife saying, can you please put the dummy back in Joey's mouth? My daughter, she's lying in bed at the moment, but obviously woke up. And the annoying thing here, guys, is that my son's a thumb sucker, right? So, he sucks his thumb and soothes himself at night. He just does that as a comforting thing. You guys will have seen kids sucking their thumbs. It's really common. Some people think it's a bad habit. It's pretty difficult to stop, so you just leave them alone. They're going to finish sucking their thumbs eventually. But my daughter never sucked her thumb, never learned to suck her thumb, and has always used a dummy, right? So, what Americans would call a pacifier. We call a dummy here. Chupeta in Portuguese. I'm always thinking in Portuguese because I speak this at home with my wife, and that's what she's texted me in. So yeah, the dummy, annoyingly, if it falls out during the night, she wakes up and just freaks because she can't find it yet. She's only 16 months old, I think, 15, 16 months old. And so, but as soon as you put it back in her mouth, she falls back to sleep. So quite often, probably two or three times at night, we have to go in there. We'll hear her having a whinge, having a cry, you know, sort of just going, eh. You go in, put the dummy straight back in her mouth, and she goes straight back to sleep. But yeah, I got another text here saying, oh, it's all good. I think she went back to sleep. So, I guess it's all good. Anyway, guys, so that's about half an hour. I hope you enjoy this episode. Listen to it multiple times. If you're having trouble understanding what I'm saying, the purpose of this content is to talk about many different topics whilst also obviously answering your questions, seeing where the conversation kind of goes, talking into your ears as if I'm standing there with you, having this kind of informal chat, and hopefully you learn something at the same time as just practicing that listening comprehension without actually reading anything, okay? So, thank you so much for joining me, and I will see you next time. Peace.